welcome to What is X with your host, Justin E. H. Smith. As regular listeners will know, on each episode of this podcast, we examine a given X, where the variable is filled in by some important, often important for philosophers, concept, such as justice, games, music, piety, virtue, or humor. So today we're looking at humor. What is humor? With my guest, Lavelle Anderson, who is a professor of philosophy at Syracuse University and is the author of the forthcoming book, The Ethics of Racial Humor, appearing with Oxford University Press, I think pretty soon. So welcome, Lavelle.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Maybe a good way to start is for you to just tell us a little bit about this book project, both perhaps what the specific philosophical problems are of racial humor, but also more generally, what is this thing, philosophy of humor? Is there such a thing? Is this a subdiscipline of ethics? Is it part of aesthetics? How does this work?
Okay. So the book itself is mainly about questions that I see arising in the social sphere around racial humor in particular. Mm-hmm. And so there have been a number of controversies or cases where some, I don't know, personality or media figure or politician, somebody like that, makes a racial joke. Mm-hmm. And then a discussion in the blogosphere or on Twitter or whatever sort of mm-hmm. blooms from that, right? So mm-hmm. is what this person said inappropriate, depending on who says it, for example, right? So mm-hmm. because the social identity of the person speaking sometimes matters for how.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, that's going to be a question I want to get back to. Yeah.
So these are the kinds of things that I'm thinking through, and I'm thinking about them in particular context. So I'm thinking about, for example, satire, which mm-hmm. is humor that's supposed to be aimed at providing social critique on some relevant issue. And so there are a number of controversies that have happened with respect to that, especially for, let's say, white pundits mm-hmm. who have tried to critique or satirize racial issues in the United States, for example. Mm-hmm. And so some bit that they've done strikes controversy mm-hmm. Because they often will either use certain types of language that's mm-hmm. you know, outside of community context, seen as mm-hmm. inappropriate or hurtful, mm-hmm. or they've broached issues that presuppose a kind of experiential knowledge that mm-hmm. seems like they don't have. So mm-hmm. there's a question about, okay, what makes it okay for this person to speak on behalf of the experiences of another?
Right.
So issues like that. Or, you know, issues around humor that is intentionally insulting, but that's mm-hmm. part of what makes it fun, right? So can right. be roasting.
Right, right, right. right.
The most dogged stereotypes or vile language mm-hmm. to sort of, as it were, honor the object right. of that
right.
activity, right? So thinking a bit about how that works, mm-hmm. or just thinking in general about how we should think about ethical considerations and how they bear on our judgments about what's funny or what's not, mm-hmm. whether or not it's a mistake to think that because some joke is ethically questionable or problematic, that somehow makes it not funny. Mm-hmm. Thinking about those sorts of things, and that's what the book is basically about.
That's okay. That's going to occupy a lot of our time later on today. What we really mean when we say something's not funny, right? Do we really mean it's not funny, or do we mean that's funny, but you shouldn't have said it, right? Okay, I love the sound of this. Now, I want to latch on to a few aspects of what you've already mentioned. I remember during, I forget if it was his presidential or mayoral campaign, but Andrew Yang made a couple of jokes that were playing on stereotypes about Asian Americans. And he couldn't get away with that. And that really struck me, because the fact that he couldn't get away with it in describing himself in ways that were ultimately positive, right? That, you know, I work hard, I'm diligent, and things like that, struck me as simply an expression of lack of faith in his personality, right? So there was so little faith in him that he couldn't even deploy stereotypes as an in-group member, right? And that was kind of an eye-opening case to me. Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah. I think this was the, was this the joke about Asian time or something that he made? I can't remember quite exactly.
All I remember is something, it had something to do with doctors, like he knows a lot of doctors because he's Asian or something. I really don't remember what it was. I just, I remember social media blew up with people at least feigning offense, that he would presume that Asian Americans are this or that way. And that struck me as kind of a breach of the general rule that in-group members have a lot more room to maneuver in what one can say about a group, right?
Because there was a similar controversy, I think, mm-hmm. that happened a few years ago on Saturday Night Live, mm-hmm. With Leslie Jones, mm-hmm, where mm-hmm. one of the skits played on, so I think the joke was about her being a desirable sexual mate during slavery because of the basically the offspring she could produce that would be basically get slaves, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it was controversial. Mm-hmm. It seemed to play on stereotypes about, you know, denigrating Black sexuality and Black women's sexuality in particular. Mm-hmm. And it, her, you know, her social identity as a Black woman didn't shield her from this criticism.
Right? That's right. So that's another example of, yeah, the presumption of having more room to maneuver as an in-group member fails. Right. Right. Yeah. So yeah, it's as if there are just a million different contextual rules, and it's up to each of us to not get them wrong, right? And that's quite a challenge. And it seems to be very much unlike other domains of social interaction where the rules are somewhat simpler, I think. But let me get back to this question, this thing that you already mentioned, you know, in some traditions like roasting or signifying rap battles, you know, when I see these on YouTube and, you know, two guys going back and forth, they will pick out any physical flaw in the other one, their height, you know, the size of their nose or whatever, and they will just tear into it, right? In ways that are utterly unacceptable in the social contexts I'm more used to, right? Like faculty meetings and so on. And yet, you know, it just seems obvious to me that that this is a good thing. It's a good thing that you have that this custom exists, and that there are people out there making fun of each other's noses in these contexts, right? So how do we make sense of all that?
Yeah, I mean, so I think one way to make sense of it is to see it as an instance of a broader practice. Mm-hmm. So I think things like roasts, as they appear in comedy club settings or in rap battles, for example, mm-hmm. These are highly ritualized practices.
Yeah. Right?
And so there's a framing around them. So as long as the participants recognize, acknowledge the framing, mm-hmm. sort of remain within the framing, then everyone has a clear idea of what to do with what's being, you know, thrown at them, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's easier to do in more formal contexts, like in a comedy club, where right. just the environment itself tutors you. And we're already tutored as, you know, people who go to comedy clubs,
right?
Then we'll know how to interact with the material that we're sort of given, right? Mm-hmm. it becomes trickier in more informal settings. I think one thing that makes, for example, roasting work between individuals has something to do with the relationship status between them, right?
Right.
Having a, I guess, a kind of more or less intimate relationship with that person then gives one a sense of the rules at play, right? So what counts as too far, for example, right? Mm-hmm. These are the kind of tacit to the assumptions that a person will bring when they know the person they're involved with.
Right.
Person they're doing this back and forth exchange with that can guide them in making these choices. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I think it does is that it sort of, again, can create more intimacy between them, right?
Right.
Because basically it's a sign of trust that, okay, if you can sling these things at me and I can sling them back at you and we can remain friends afterwards, we've sort of shown that we can build up a strong relationship with one another.
Right.
By knowing these intimate details about one another and wielding them in ways that are meant to, I guess, in some ways deflate perhaps inflated self-conceptions, but perhaps.
Yeah. I've heard the argument that this kind of playing up stereotypes in a humorous way in some particularly working class settings, like factory workers, can sometimes serve to defuse inter-ethnic conflict, right? So there's jesting and jibing that plays up ethnic stereotypes among co-workers of different ethnic groups in ways that, again, in our more rarefied settings in academia, we find totally off limits, but might be a way of actually dealing with the potential for more serious conflict. So when you were talking about the question of, you know, building up intimacy, I think you were talking about, say, two friends and likely two friends who come from the same community. But there's another context where it's people encountering each other, say, between ethnic or religious communities. Do you think the same thing is at work there?
I think it's possible. So I think that, yeah. And so especially in these settings where getting ahead or having access to certain goods isn't dependent on keeping up a kind of, I don't know, pristine public performance.
Yeah. Right.
The opportunity for a kind of real life, true, less performative interaction. Especially in settings like this that you're talking about, in like the factory or something like that, where, yeah, again, these kinds of engagements are really this sort of signaling, signaling to one another. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to engage with you at the personal level.
Right.
Willing to meet you face to face rather than to send out my personal representative to engage with you.
Right. Yeah.
You see, yeah. I think this has been one way, I think, that some theorists have talked about the interactions in military settings between soldiers from different ethnic and cultural backgrounds, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
This kind of crude interacting with one another using language that's generally unacceptable in the more, you know, quote unquote, respectable public setting.
Right.
That's what this happens. It's to build a kind of trust with one another because you kind of laying yourself bare.
Yeah. That's a kind of, life and death setting where developing human bonds is particularly urgent. Yeah. Do you think people in these respectable settings have something to learn from those other settings? Is that maybe something, one of the results of your work, that it exposes the kind of people who would read a book on the ethics of racial humor to communities and subcultures that deal with racial humor differently than we do in, again, our respectable setting? I mean, I assume both of us, in fact, belong to several different settings, some of which are more respectable than others, but the one that we're meeting in is the respectable setting of academia and its para-academic arms like podcasts, right? That's what I mean when I say our respectable setting.
Yeah, I think there's something to be learned from these engagements at the quote-unquote less respectable level.
Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
Is that often the bar for ethical engagement, the bar for what counts as morally good and bad and to what respect, is set at the levels that we sort of track in professionally, it seems like. Mm-hmm. But that then can give a kind of, I think they can overemphasize certain things and underemphasize others, right?
Yeah, right.
And so, yeah, I think one way to think about this is with respect to the kind of public performances that people with certain kinds of, stakes see mm-hmm. themselves having to do in order to hang on to that stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist at these other levels.
Yeah, right.
I'm not entirely sure how I think it bears on the ethics of the joking, right? So I don't know that because it can have these, crude humor, for example, mm-hmm. can have mm-hmm. potential advantages for breaking through these social performances that keep us from interacting with one another truly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it makes them more ethically
mm-hmm.
or ethically praiseworthy or whatever.
Right.
That there may be a kind of balancing we have to think about, right? Mm-hmm. To think about the goodness and badness of these acts as acts
mm-hmm.
and the potential benefits or advantages they could provide in other domains or independently or something like that.
Let's step back. Humor is such a weird thing because there are so many different kinds of humor, crude humor, you know, just like the most infantile jokes about bodily functions, up to creative wordplay. And you wonder what is the unifying thing? What is humor in general? Is there anything that philosophy can do to help us answer that question?
Yes, I would say that. So generally said that the sustained philosophical attention to humor began around the 19th century, mm-hmm, 19th century, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing that the discussion in these literatures has shown is that, one, we should take care to distinguish between humor and laughter.
Mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
oftentimes
right. Concepts
are read together, but they're quite distinct, right? So,
right.
And thinking about them distinctly helps us then keep track of important differences between the two, right?
Mm-hmm.
So laughter, it seems to be like a kind of physical or physical expression, let's say,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it can have different functions, right? So it can be used to express amusement, enjoyment of something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It can be used to express ridicule or scorn of something, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It can be used to try to show that you fit into situations, a kind mm-hmm. of, you know, social catharsis or something like that.
Right.
Whereas humor seems to be, with respect to one definition of humor, it's
mm-hmm.
the object of what produces, you know, comic amusement.
Let's say. Mm-hmm. Right.
There you can be amused by something without giving off the physical sign of laughter.
Right? Mm-hmm.
It's possible to be in an amused state without laughing.
Right, right, right.
So I think that's one thing that I think the literature has done. It's distinguished between these two concepts that are often ran together and therefore confuses a number of other things that we care about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But also I think there is kind of division of labor too.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophy can help, I think, try to provide some analytic clarity
mm-hmm.
to the way that we understand various concepts,
mm-hmm.
but also find humor itself as a kind of interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
Right. So it's impossible, I think, to understand humor without paying attention to what psychologists say or anthropologists say.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a kind of very broad phenomenon that requires knowledge from a lot of different areas.
Right, right.
But it's a minimal part that should see itself as part of a pretty comprehensive approach to understanding this that is quite ubiquitous, right? So it ranges cross-culturally.
Yeah. It's also important, though, to recognize how contextual it is. I don't know if you've encountered this document called the Philogelos, which is an ancient Greek joke book. There are like a couple hundred jokes in it. And, you know, it's been translated now. It's circulating on the internet. Most of them are just completely incomprehensible. They're like, half of them are about lettuce. I don't know why. Like, the Greeks thought lettuce was really funny. And, you know, it just had this power to make people laugh. And, you know, reading the Philogelos is funny at kind of a meta level, because you just think, what? How did people find this humorous? And even, I think, you know, if we watch comedy routines from the 1930s or 40s, you can easily have this feeling like, okay, this is interesting, but I feel like I'm watching, you know, a foreign culture here, even if it's, you know, a Hollywood movie, right? So everything changes so fast. And this might actually be, like, getting back to ethics, one good reason to say that against the kind of people who are constantly battling against political correctness under various banners, that, you know, language changes just like humor changes. And when you say something is not funny, it's just because the times are changing. That doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't funny when Lenny Bruce or Richard Pryor said it. It just means that that you can't keep milking it decades later, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's what I think Peter Kibbe used to call conditional. Right? So condition is tied to humor. So it's very specific. You know, and it's background assumptions that we just take for granted, right?
Yeah.
Which I think indicates that humor is this kind of, I like to think of it as a kind of dialogue with respect to its culture, the cultural milieu in which it's set.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So let's try to, your book is timely because I think people now, perhaps more than ever before, are hyper attuned to failures to hit the target, right? In humor. And this is probably just because we have this new technology that lets us express it, namely social media. But we're now familiar, like never before, I think, with the difficulty of being funny in public, because, you know, there's always the risk of making a false move, going too far, stepping over the line. Is it just the new technology, or have we discovered something new?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in part, I want to say that the new technology is a bit misleading. So, yeah, we do get real-time feedback on what various people think about some special or joke or whatever. But I often wonder how representative some of those are. And so we get, for example, maybe some story, a think piece on some special and about audience reception of it based on very prominent Twitter threads, for example, or something like that.
Yeah.
It was never clear to me how representative those threads are.
Right.
Because there seem to be a kind of mismatch between what the think pieces will say about some piece and sort of a more representative sample of audience response to something, right?
Right, yeah.
And I think the think piece thing is often geared towards a kind of ameliorative project or something like that, right? So they take the humor to be offensive and out of step with what we should think of as our political and moral goals. And then we're trying to direct the audience to think about that stuff.
Yeah, right.
But then that gets folded into judgments about whether or not the performance itself or the joke itself was funny or not. Right.
Right.
So there's a confusing of these things, I think, that happens.
Right, right.
So the thing that I think that social media does is gives us real time feedback, mm-hmm. and doesn't allow, for example, official media channels to shape their narrative in the way that it wishes.
Right, 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 right.
But then I think it tends to also give us a false impression of what is actually the state of play, like what's true,
right,
representative,
right,
response to some special joke or whatever.
Yeah, there. And in fact, here, that probably doesn't differ much from what also happens in politics, right? You have the extremely online minority of people, right, who, you know, are trying to shape political debate in one way, even though the great majority of people are just glued to their TV sets and are perceiving things very differently. It's probably much the same as that with the shaping of opinion about, say, Dave Chappelle, right?
Right.
But I mean, Dave Chappelle is an interesting case because clearly his like most recent intervention was clearly shaped by his own awareness of what people have been saying he should or shouldn't be saying, right? And that almost pushes stand-up comedy as an art form into new territory, right? Because it's now staking out positions in the discourse more than it is shocking people or breaking down conventional values, or I don't know. It seems to be moving in a new direction as a result of these social media pressures. Do you have that impression as well?
Yeah, I've been trying to think about what I think about what's going on there, Spector Chappelle in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, given some things he said in the previous couple of specials, like the closer and the one before that,
mm-hmm.
there's a way to read it that it seems like his bit is really, in essence, poking at audiences in general, right?
Mm-hmm.
So talk about sort of his trans jokes.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost incidental to what I think the main punchline is supposed to be. Yeah, I think he's basically attempting to satirize audiences. So I think so this is the bit where I think, again, the way to understand humor is as a dialogue with the social milieu in which it's situated.
Right.
I think, you know, given all the public chatter about cancel culture and whatever, mm-hmm. that this is his foray into that and his foray into audience sensibilities, right?
Yeah.
And he's pressing on something he knows is a hot sort of social topic, but using it instrumentally to try to do something else.
And
talk about whether or not, you know, that's sort of misguided, misinformed, and so forth, right?
Mm.
But I think that's what's happening. And so I think in a sense, you're right, that he's trying to stake out, you know, his sort of plot of land back to discourse, ethics, let's say, mm-hmm. You know, how one should, what one should speak about, how one should speak about it in public and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just sort of trying to do it in a provocative way.
Mm-hmm.
But that, audience attitudes seem to be the main punchline of his jokes. It's the, I think
right.
the setup leads to the punchline, which is about, you know, I think something he mentioned in one of the earlier specials about having a brittle spirit, I think is the mm-hmm. main phrase, right? And so I think he's charging audiences with having brittle spirits.
They're
trying to demonstrate that.
Right. I suppose it's when it's a few, maybe 2 years or so earlier when, you know, he kind of was thrust forward as the polar opposite of Hannah Gadsby, who also represents a tendency in comedy that is pushing it, from my point of view, into something completely different, right? It kind of like stand up, stand-up observationalist who kind of satisfies the needs of a particular identity group might be one way to describe it, rather than stand-up comedy. But then that polarization between them maybe captured Chappelle in something he didn't want. I don't know. I should also say I'm not terribly familiar with stand-up comedy. I don't pay that much attention to it. I mostly just read about it on social media.
I want to jump in there for a moment if I can. So the juxtaposition between Chappelle and Gatsby is interesting. I see them as probing basically a similar issue. Freedom, this notion of freedom in comedy and the limits of comedy, especially satirical comedy.
Yeah, right.
So Chappelle has been on record as sort of decrying the attack on freedom in this space. You think that this is the last space for freedom of speech or something like that. And it's himself as a defender of freedom of speech. Right? Mm-hmm. Gatsby, especially in Nanette, is, again, I think she's also probing or poking at the notion of freedom in comedy, but showing that it's severely limited, that indeed, to take up humor as a site where you critique or provide a kind of moral corrective for certain kinds of attitudes is severely limited. Because what sort of rules, I guess the guiding principle for the comedian is, you know, getting laughs, right? That's the primary job of the comic, to make things laugh. But that, Gatsby thinks, constrains what the comic can do, right? And so in retelling the story about, you know, her approaching a woman in a bar and then that boyfriend getting upset or whatever, she leaves out crucial details, like later, that she was assaulted by this guy, right? So including that information in the setup of the joke basically would thwart laughter. Right.
So she's offering an ethical critique of humor within her routine, right? Is that so the imperative of the comedian is to get laughs, and that puts comedy potentially in a tense relationship with the ethical, right? What is your view as an ethicist and as a philosopher of humor between humor and morality? Is it a necessarily tense relationship, or is it one that could potentially be worked out to everyone's satisfaction? Because this is like getting back to this question of when people say that's not funny. Each time I hear someone say somewhat scoldingly, that's not funny, it's as if they're presupposing that there's some clear way of doing humor that would keep you always on the safe side, rather than humor being just kind of intrinsically, you know, flirting with the fire, right? If that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I myself don't think that there's anything to be said for what counts as funny. If thinking about sort of identifying that one thing or whatever, or that small set of things that make something funny, I probably think that doesn't exist. I mean, I do think that, at least as I understand contemporary humor practices, it just seems sort of built into its DNA to challenge norms.
Right, right, yeah.
With those norms, whatever they might be. Right? And so that includes ethical norms or moral norms.
Right.
Things that we take ourselves to have settled for how we interact with one another and treat each other become dogma or just accepted, sort of unconsciously, or accepted without, you know, a qualification or something. Like, those are the areas I think that comedians, especially ones who are attempting to produce something that's sort of new or that pushes the practice of comedy further along, those are the places they seek out to do it, right?
Right, right.
And in fact, you see this in, for example, a note that Amy Schumer wrote, I think, back where, you know, when she was challenged for some bit that she did, like sort of explicitly expresses this idea that as a comedian, it's my job to seek out these places of comfort.
Yeah, right.
And break those rules or norms that people cherish or whatever. Take that to be a quite general attitude amongst comedians.
Yeah.
That sets up a kind of, you know, tense relationship between what comedians are going to be doing and the things we regard as the sacred ethical norms or practices or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Has there ever been an example of a comedian saying something where you felt the pile on was justified, where they went over a line where you agreed that they deserved to be walloped for this? Or have you?
So I think one clear case for me was Don Imus's joke about the Rutgers women's basketball team, where he appealed
to sister at that. I remember that. Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think it is meant as a joke, but because it's in, you know, it was in this in the context of a comedic radio show. There were issues about framing, for example. Like, it's not entirely clear how to think about that.
Yeah.
But also, I think the way in which he made the joke didn't really leave us as viewers or as audience members much room to think about, you know, how to think about this in a way that basically doesn't double down on harmful tropes, stigmas that already mark, let's say, Black women,
right,
Americans.
Right, yeah. Right. I always found Don Imus so cretinous that I'm predisposed to see him get walloped for saying something he shouldn't have said. But that, you know, that's also, you know, a distorting factor in the way I assess whether he had it coming or not. By contrast, you know, I might be revealing really, really objectionable taste, but I always found something likable about Howard Stern, even in his most objectionable routines, because it seemed to me that with him, part of the routine was a kind of underlying self-hatred. And like, he would always come back with side comments about how miserable he is in all of his nastiness towards other people. And this is particularly striking when he has Donald Trump on his show in the, I guess, the early 2000s. And, you know, it seems to me that Stern is being self-aware and turning himself into a joke. And Trump is just thinking, how can I ingratiate myself with this guy? And it's with no self-awareness at all, right? And the two different psychologies are so striking, and it makes a difference, I think, morally, but also in terms of what we find humorous. But, you know, I always think I could be reading that totally wrong, and someone else could have a totally different takeaway.
I think that's often one way that try to establish the frame explicitly for an audience, right? So generally, like, the more ridiculous you can make yourself seem as a character, the more success you generally have in communicating to the audience how the this thing. And
yeah,
at least I think as an explanation for what would distinguish Stern from Trump, I think that's a good one. Because Stern does seem to be operating with this kind of self-awareness. Often makes himself the butt of the joke, right? In a way that Trump is just being straightforward. Like,
yeah,
I think he's just sort of, I think he's telling the truth about himself, right?
That's all you get, yeah. Yeah.
So it might be, that's a funny thing about him, but he's not funny.
Right. That's an interesting distinction as well, yeah. But yeah, and then obviously we all have different sensibilities, but I confess to really having a soft spot for Don Rickles, Jackie Mason, you know, the people whose whole shtick is to be obnoxiously cruel. And part of it is because I see them as just broken characters. And there's something, it's almost not so much funny as it is poignant, you know, to see people lashing out in this way. But yeah, it's hard to analyze, right? It's hard to figure out what makes that funny and what the relationship of the funniness of it to morality is.
So this reminds me of what some people have thought about, for example, All in the Family when it came out.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. Yeah, that comes up a lot. Yeah.
Bunker, right? Where I think Lear clearly had in mind Bunker as a kind of critique of a certain kind.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
American attitude in the 60s, 70s. But then the fear was that people wouldn't read this as a critique, but rather kind of reinforcement of these attitudes and ideas.
Right.
The same way that the controversy over the New Yorker cover with Barack Obama and Kenyon Garb and Michelle, like Angela Davis with an AK or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Clearly presented as a kind of satirical critique on the talk about them at the time.
Right.
The concern seemed to be that this wouldn't be read as a critique, but again, it's kind of endorsement of the attitudes that are being critiqued.
Right.
And this seems to be, again, a place where those these two judgments we can have that sometimes ran together, right? So there's one question about the features of this performance that might amuse me or not.
Right.
On the other hand, there's concern about the social implications or the social effects that this thing might have.
Right.
And go beyond me, and that might put someone else in danger.
Right.
And then there's a kind of struggle to think about how to think about these two things together. Right.
Yeah. I suppose one place that tension became particularly pronounced was here in France in 2015 with the Charlie Hebdo incidents. And I think the editors of Charlie Hebdo became really intransigent, dogmatic about satire being satire, full stop, rather than looking at the way satire exists in an evolving world and what passes as good satire in 1975 might not be the same as in 2015. Nonetheless, how do you establish rules for what is to count as good satire? There, I think the surviving editors of Charlie Hebdo still have a point, right? Like, you can't say in advance where the boundary is, because the whole project is trying to flirt with the boundary as much as possible, right?
I think that's right. Right. There's a heavy contextual element to it, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you know, actually, come to think of it, my family has a close family friend who's Archie Bunker's generation, and we always kind of thought of him as Archie Bunker. You know, the Bunkers are coming to visit, and he actually liked because his politics actually lined up pretty closely with Archie's. And, you know, in a sense, it validated him, even though it was supposed to be a critique. I hadn't really thought about that so much, but yeah, that's exactly what you were pointing out.
It's interesting, right? Because sometimes judgments about what makes satire good often include this language about subtlety, right? So the more subtle it is, the better. But that's a component of good satire, that it's subtle, right? So if it's, it's on the nose, it's kind of pedantic, kind of, you know, after school specially, so you know, really want a good making feature. But then you run into this potential problem, right? But if it's too subtle, people won't recognize it.
So it seems like satire is just intrinsically a dangerous business, right? There's no way around it. Let's talk more about the specifically racial dimension of your work on the ethics of humor. Are there particular problems that racial humor generates? Let me just say before that, I can think of other cultural contexts where there, even in here in France, there are stock ethnic types for jokes, some of which are so disconnected from reality and so irrelevant to actual kind of social encounters that people have that we barely even think of them as potentially offensive. And that seems to be kind of what's happened with, say, Polish jokes in the United States.
Right.
I don't know, maybe some Polish Americans are hurt by them, but for the most part, it's just kind of a catalog of humor that we have that, uses a stock type and no one gets hurt. But racial humor is presumably different than that. It is something that is almost by definition charged, right? Charged up with potential to cause real trouble. And I'm assuming that's why it's more interesting as a topic for your book.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Right. So part of the way I try to think about this is, again, thinking about the kind of social context in which these jokes happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm thinking about humor, especially humor about race, that happens particularly in racially stratified social orders, social structure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I think the stratification has an impact on these kinds, on these practices.
Yeah.
And so given, the reality of social inequality and racial stratification, also given what I think about how humor often functions, right, which is to seek out those tensions, or seek out those places where there's a kind of almost taboo-like aspect to the norms or whatever that people are observing, then in these kinds of situations, those kinds of lines are going off, most often they're going to deal with race in some sort of way, right? Especially in Western capitalist nation states, right?
Right.
And so I think what makes it interesting for me is to think about and I guess this is in a sense related to some of the conversation you had with Jason Stanley on Slurred.
Yeah, right, right.
About this, what I would call the duality of language, the kind of potential for language to hurt, but also for it to heal or to challenge or critique or something like that, right? And I think that we see sort of intellectual and political movement traditions that have made use of language and issues around race to attempt to address or challenge the ways that race has been used to create these social orders that disadvantage certain groups, right?
Right.
And we see we might think we see the potential for humor to start to address some of this stuff by historical examples. So people like Dick Gregory, for example.
Right. Yeah. I was going to mention Dick Gregory. Yeah.
Who was like the first Black comedian to successfully kind of stand in front of white audiences in this way, right? To challenge those prejudices and attitudes that were common stock in the American. I think one way sometimes people talk about humor and its potential is that it's a way of bypassing that rational mechanism, a way of getting to people through mechanisms that they're more acceptable of, that they're more relaxed, right, and willing to engage with, right? So, people are willing to sort of stomach and tolerate and take on board for the sake of conversation stuff presented in a humorous way.
Right.
When you're sort of giving it to them straight up as a means of deliberation or something like that.
Yeah. So Dick Gregory could say a lot more things a lot more straightforwardly when he presents himself as a comic than if he were testifying before the Senate or something like that, right?
That's right. So I think the thing about race for me that makes these questions, these sort of ethical or metaphysical or linguistic questions about humor interesting, is that it has, I think, a deep impact and influence on how we should respond to those questions about, you know, what does some joke mean or how should I interpret it? What effect does the social identity of the joke tell I have on what kind of joke is made? Or what joke? Because it's a practice that's socially embedded. So I think if we keep track of that reality, that these aren't just acts that happen in this sort of neutral space. It always happens in the context of something, right?
Right.
In the social context. And that social context has an impact on how it is we, what jokes we think we can tell in which settings, how we
understand
what's being said and so forth. I think it's an important piece of the puzzle for understanding, for example, what makes something funny.
Right. Yeah, in a way, it shouldn't be at all surprising that who the teller is such a crucial element, given that humor is so dependent on contextual factors, right? And obviously, you know, who's speaking is a major contextual factor, right?
Right.
But so it's both there, you know, what you've described just now sounds a lot more like you're interested in probing the potentials that might be harnessed for even social progress that are latent in racial humor, rather than what I would have thought at the outset from looking at the brief description of the book, that you're interested in exploring the dangers and transgressions and misfires, right? You're doing both, but you see potential for progress there as well, right?
I do, though I'm very tentative about the extent of the potential. I do think there have been a number of critiques that show that there does tend to be an over-reliance on humor as a panacea. So I guess I regard that as a kind of danger too. So I want to paint out the picture of the potential, but I'll warn against relying on that potential as a kind of possibility that doesn't also have its dangers.
Yeah, I would describe it as something like palliative, right? Like in the Trump years in particular, Saturday Night Live seemed to turn into a kind of palliation for people who felt helpless. And it was almost painful to watch because, you know, it was just acting out fantasies of a world that seemed out of reach, right? Which wasn't funny, right? At least in my opinion. And but then by contrast, someone like Dick Gregory really does seem to throw a bit of a bomb into society, or, you know, shake things up in a way that seems to me to really change things. But then, of course, you also have examples of people like, say, Richard Pryor, who are kind of harder to analyze critically because I take him to be someone who's mostly just exposing his own weakness and being a bit freakish for the audience in a way that, again, I find very poignant, but I don't quite know what it does for the progress of racial equality in the United States, if anything, or, you know, if that's just irrelevant to understanding the kind of person Richard Pryor was.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Richard's an interesting case. Because some of the material that is based on it, a lot of the material is autobiographical, and he's figures that, I guess, in the history of comedy sort of sets this on its track, right? The sort of new style of comedy or whatever.
Yeah.
I think there is, there's one way you could read what Pryor does as consistent with earlier, say, Black aesthetic movements, thinking of like the the Harlem Renaissance, or the New Negro Movement.
Yeah.
And where part of the agenda, the goal was to produce African-American aesthetic works that sort of exhibited, displayed African-American humanness, right?
Yeah. Right.
And so you could think of Pryor's routines as a way of doing that, right? Showing sort of the distinctively human bits of a Black.
Yeah. So observational comedy as a kind of reinforcement or exposure of the humanity of the comedian, right? But then in the case of someone like Richard Pryor, who seems like a particularly tragic character, it's not just human, it's so human that it's hard to watch, right? At least that's how I remember him. So what do you have left to do in this project? How is this, how's it developing? Are you done with the book?
I am trying to complete the draft. I essentially have it all worked out. I have chapter drafts here and there, basically revising here or trying to refashion arguments that I took, I don't know, thought up years ago and now trying to update for now. I think the last thing I have to do is add a preface or something to address basically the Chappelle controversy stuff and what.
Oh, okay. Really? Yeah. That's tough, isn't it? When you're, I know, because I just finished writing a book on, broadly speaking, the philosophy of the internet. And it's hard because you want your book to be readable in 20 years. So you don't want to get too wrapped up in what people are talking about right now. But then, you know, you also have to address the age you live in. And it sounds like that's what you're doing in this book. You're trying to talk about familiar reference points in our culture.
Exactly.
Circa 2022. One more question I had for you. I've thought about this a lot. You can be a specialist in aesthetics, right, without being an artist. And presumably, in a similar way, you can be a philosopher of humor without being funny, right? You can be a totally straight-laced square and still give the most brilliant analysis of how humor works imaginable, right? But it's probably pretty important to if you're going to write a book about the philosophy of humor, it's probably pretty important to have a good sense of humor, isn't it?
I don't think so. I mean,
were you attracted to this topic because you found yourself kind of naturally gravitating towards the uncle who told the funniest jokes and always kind of attuned to that level of reality?
I think it was a natural topic for me. Probably because I grew up in a home that appreciated at a deep level. I watched comedy shows with my parents. I grew up at a time where things like Comic Viewer and Living Color were on TV. My parents. And also, we just have this kind of rich tradition in our family. I have four siblings, and so. We had this tradition of roasting one another, essentially. An everyday kind of thing for me. And then,
right.
To write about it, it was like sort of icing on the cake, I guess.
Right. Does that come through in your writing? Do you feel like your life path as someone who was just naturally roasting your siblings from the crib? Is that expressed in your work, or are you more of a kind of straight-laced analytic philosopher, right? Because it's hard, right? It's hard to combine the two worlds, right? You grew up roasting your siblings, and then the next thing you know, you're in the PhD program in philosophy at Rutgers, and people are telling you you have to be making rigorous arguments, and there's like this whole other domain of your existence that you have to close off, right? Have you found that hard?
No one says so. I think I draw inspiration from my experiences.
Mm.
And maybe that comes through in the writing. I hope, mm-hmm. anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I suppose that if the relationship between my experiences and my academic work,
mm-hmm.
is that the academic work just relies on experiences, it's motivated by experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that, mm-hmm. is sort of the motivating factor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, mm-hmm. really difficult kind of negotiation for me because I just see it,
yeah.
naturally steamed powered by one is not,
yeah, right.
the other.
Yeah. That's interesting. I'm happy for you. I'm glad that the two go together so smoothly. And maybe, you know, maybe that's a promising sign that our discipline of analytic philosophy is loosening up a bit, right? That it can entertain examples drawn from a wider field of experiences than, say, your typical mid-20th century philosopher of language would have been able to do, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
I guess also I'm in a way I take myself to be speaking beyond analytic philosophy too.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And so,
yeah,
I think in part that shapes me as well, that I'm interested in talking to a number of different people. I try to keep track,
right.
of who those people are. And that guides my considerations for like what questions I take up or how
right.
and so forth.
That's the right approach. I think I agree with you there. Absolutely. Listen, we've been talking for quite a while. I don't think we are going to come to a shared definition of what humor is. So I think technically we're ending in aporia. but that's okay. I mean, you and I talked, well, let's talk about this just a little bit beforehand. I mean, you and I talked a little bit before we started recording about the philosophy of humor and, you know, the fact that there is a standard kind of set of classical theories from Hobbes and Kant and Freud and Bergson and so on. And they all seem to, do some good for shining light on what humor is, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Even if it seems like a waste of time to try to say which one of them is right. Right. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, now as it stands, the consensus view amongst humor, mm-hmm. theorists seems to be the what's called the incongruity theory, right? So
yeah.
Humor is what's produced by sort of a dashed expectations, essentially.
Right, right. Then that's from Kant, right?
The right.
sudden transformation of a strained expectation into nothing or something like that. Right. But Kant is hilarious, right? Because when he's in the course of giving that theory, he says, for example, let me tell you this joke. Do you remember this? And then it's just like the stupidest joke you could imagine, where he's talking to, I guess he says, an Indian in Surat who doesn't understand how they got the foam into a bottle of beer or something like that. And you're just like, what? This is the kind of joke Kant likes? so it's a perfect example, right? That it's, you know, that you can have a, you can be a humor theorist without having a good sense of humor. Right. So what, I mean, but briefly, what do you think of the incongruity theory? Cause I tend to find it pretty, you know, pretty compelling as an account of what's happening most of the time.
Yeah. I think it explains a lot. Yeah. Often there's a kind of setup where the punchline is filled in by something you're not expecting.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's incongruous with the framing of the setup or something like that.
Right, and right, right.
For the most part, I think that does describe a lot of humor.
A lot of it, yeah.
But at the same time, there's something to kind of, you know, Freudian or Spencerian kind of relief theory where...
Yeah, right, right.
Social tension is in the air and humor comes in to kind of dissolve some of that tension or whatever. That's what
right
is, kind of this release valve or something like that.
Right, right. Right, release valve. Yeah.
Too, right.
Yeah.
But there's also lots of humor that seems to trade on the butt of the joke being read as inferior to the audience.
Right, right. The inferiority theory. Yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a lot of mean humor.
Yeah.
A lot of vicious humor that made humor an unpopular sort of thing, especially amongst, you know, theologians in the medieval and early 17th century.
Right, right, right.
So I think that things, I think there are things that these classical views capture.
Yeah.
So that not one of those views is the sort of overall comprehensive view that explains everything we want to explain about humor.
Yeah, that sounds exactly right to me. It's too complex a phenomenon to have a single theory that would do all the work. So I guess in that sense, we're in agreement. Let's call it agreement. Listen, Lavelle, it's really been great to talk to you. I can't wait to read your book. When is it coming out?
There's no determined release date yet. I'm working to get it to them. Hopefully it will be released by the end of the year.
By the end of the year. Okay. We'll hope for that. Yeah. But yeah, publishing moves slowly. So yeah, take all the time you need. anyhow, it's a great project. And this has been a really enjoyable conversation. So once again, this is What is X? And I have been speaking with Lavelle Anderson on the topic of humor and what it is. And I hope you'll join us here for the next episode. My name is Justin E.H. Smith, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.